It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep. Good morning. Have no idea why you're up this early on a holiday, but we're glad you're with us for this next story, which begins with a line from the English poet Vita Sackville-West, who wrote, "Small pleasure must correct great tragedies." That line starts a new book about war gardens. There have been victory gardens grown in times of scarcity and also gardens planted along hostile fronts. The trenches of World War I, the ghettos of World War II, even today in the deserts of Iraq. On this Memorial Day, NPR senior correspondent Ketzel Levine tells the story of these defiant gardens.
A shovel, a seed, a watering can. Each is a weapon that can debilitate an enemy when that enemy is loneliness or despair. But what if that enemy's out to annihilate you, to quite literally take your life? Digging, planting, and watering might seem senseless. Kenneth Helfand calls them acts of defiance.
Dramatically against the odds, dramatically a symbol of human perseverance, even in the face of death.
In wanting to understand just how profoundly we are affected by gardens, this professor of landscape architecture spent several years researching historic and contemporary gardens created under extreme duress.
Perhaps the most extreme circumstance that human beings have created, sadly for themselves, is war.
Heavy machine gun fire.
Iraq, a hostile, parched landscape. For a National Guardsman weaned on the black loam of North Dakota, the moon dust passing for soil here is no place like home.
My name is Sergeant Carl J. Quam with the 141st Engineer Combat Battalion, and I was stationed in FOB Spiker, which is right outside of Tikrit, Iraq.
During his one-year tour of duty, Sergeant Quam and his men ran up to 6 combat patrols a week.
My battalion lost 4 guys, and every day on the road was, you know, technically could have been the last day of your life. And our garden time usually consisted of late evenings or when we came back from missions.
Sergeant Quam borrowed cultivation ideas from Iraqi gardeners and successfully raised sweet carrots, cauliflower, and bushels of corn in lean, porous soil. The fresh produce was a treat, certainly, but his impulse to grow something nourished a deeper need.
Just coming back to that garden, it was a release. For a little while, you could put your mind off of what was happening to you and around you in country. That little bit of time in the evening, things seemed right again, you know, they seemed real.
Keep the home fire burning while your hearts are yearning.
Home, for those fighting in World War I, was an 8-foot ditch of stinking mud, a place described as an unroofed tomb.
The landscape of the First World War on the Western Front was continuous trenches, and millions of soldiers spent portions of their lives there. Along those lines, soldiers created gardens.
1916, from a soldier's letter home. Would you be so kind as to send me some flower seeds, sweet peas, convolvulus, sunflower? I don't know how long I may be stuck here, and I want to grow some flowers. Whether the snowdrops growing in spent cartridge shells or the rhododendrons scavenged from a ruined chateau, Kenneth Helfand's book, Defiant Gardens, repeatedly speaks of soldiers transcending war.
You have gardens on one side of these trenches, and gardens, they're hopeful, they're life-giving. On the opposite side of the trenches is this no man's land. So it might be a very conventional garden in your backyard. In this horrific landscape, its meaning is magnified.
This is the national program from London. Germany has invaded Poland and has bombed many towns.
The place I went next was to the ghettos, the gardens created by Jews in the ghettos under the Nazis during the Second World War.
Of course, there are no remaining gardens in what were the ghettos. Kenneth Helfand could only guess their whereabouts using the scribbled narratives of men and women once trapped inside. One such narrative describes an emaciated Jew desperately striking his crowbar against the merciless, intractable ground.
To some people, talking about ghetto and talking about gardens, it sounds like a paradox.
Roman Kent argues that if a garden is a place of beauty in which to dream, There was no such thing as a ghetto garden. The stony allotment he and his brother tended in the Lutz ghetto was simply a way to fight starvation, and for a few years it did keep the family alive.
I was amazed how much the piece of land could give us food, cabbage, lettuce, carrots, beets, cucumbers, and of course potatoes.
But as the walls closed in on a desperate community where death by hunger was routine, mobs ransacked anything edible. In the summer of 1944, a teenage Roman Kent stood helpless as his garden was destroyed.
Within an hour or two, the fields were empty of all the greenery. Nothing was left. Nothing. And I know I stood there and I started really crying, sobbing. Of course, at that point, I did not realize that it really didn't matter because shortly thereafter, everybody was sent out to Auschwitz.
Mm. And did you ever garden again?
No, I did not.
When the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor, our west coast became a potential combat zone.
The gardens created by Japanese Americans in the internment camps during the Second World War are great American gardens.
When Yasusuke Kogita was sent with his sons to the Minidoka internment camp in Idaho, he brought very little from his home in Seattle, but he did bring a plant. That willow grew to an impressive size during the family's 4 years behind barbed wire, weeping over a wartime garden defined by massive rocks.
Just to get those rocks out there, come out in the sagebrush. And remember the two-wheel cart Dad built?
Like an ox cart without an ox yoke on there. We were the two oxes.
The two boys, now in their 70s, are Paul and Ted Kogita, who helped their father load every rock when the camp was closed. Those rocks, veritable sculptures of sandstone weighing as much as 2 tons, are now in Paul Kogita's Seattle garden, where his brother sits by the pond, remembering his father at his most serene.
You'll sit there and look at it and then move a rock just a little bit and sit there a couple hours and twist it around.
And those are the memories from Minidoka his sons continue to lean on, memories of their father's steady focus, day by day, stone by stone.
Oh, that garden meant so much to him, probably more than life. If he lost that garden, he lost his hope.
Because he couldn't control what was going on there, but he could control his garden. And
he could tune everything else out.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
The other stuff, what can you do? Especially behind barbed wire.
Perhaps, particularly behind barbed wire, small pleasure must correct great tragedies. And so we irrigate dust, plant in mud, coax a beet out of rubble. Acts of grace amidst the profanities of war. Ketzel Levine, NPR News.
Oh, I'm looking here at photographs of war gardens from the trenches of the Western Front to the army camps of Iraq, and you can see them at npr.org.